The fit of whimsical good humour that had prompted Emery Staines, on his arrival in Dunedin, to commission a natal chart from Mrs. Lydia Wells, medium, spiritist, had been only intensified by the forecast itself, which, being uniformly providential, had put him in such high spirits that he felt inclined to celebrate. He had awoken the next morning with a terrible headache and a guilty sensation of indebtedness. Upon applying to the hotelier, he discovered, to his alarm, that he was in debt to the house to the tune of £8, having put up a fortnight's stipend on a game of brag, only to lose every penny of it, and £5 more. The circumstances under which he had become so grossly indebted were somewhat hazy in his memory, and he begged the hotelier for a cup of coffee on credit, so that he might sit a while and consider how best to proceed. This request was granted, and he was still sitting at the bar some 3/4 of an hour later when Francis Carver appeared, sponsorship papers in hand. Carver made his offer in plain speech and without preamble. He would provide enough capital to furnish Staines with a miner's right, a swag, and a ticket to the nearest payable goldfield. He added casually that he would also be happy to pay any debts that Staines might have incurred in Dunedin since his arrival the previous day. In return, Staines would agree to sign over half shares of his first claim, with dividends in perpetuity, and this income would be routed back to Carver's account in Dunedin by private mail. Emery Staines knew at once that he had been played for a fool. He remembered enough of the early hours of the previous evening to know that Carver had been excessively solicitous of him, ensuring that his bets were always matched, his company was always lively, and his glass was always filled. He also had the shadowy sense that the gambling debt had been imposed upon him in some way, for his weakness for cards was of a very ordinary, cheerful sort, and he had never before thrown away such a large sum of money in a single evening. But he was amused that he had been swindled so soon after his adventure began, and his amusement led him to feel a kind of affection for Carver, as one feels affection for a crafty opponent in chess. He decided to chalk the whole business up to experience, and accepted Carver's terms of sponsorship with characteristic good humour, but he resolved privately to be more vigilant in the future. To have been bested once was diverting, but he swore that he would not be bested a second time. Staines was not a terribly good judge of character. He loved to be enchanted, and so was very often drawn to persons whose manner was suggestive of tragedy, romance, or myth. If he suspected that there was a strain of something very dastardly in Carver, he conceived of that quality only in the most fanciful, piratical sense. Had he pursued this impression, he would have found only that it delighted him. Carver was more than 20 years Staines senior, and was as brawny and dark as Staines was slight and fair. He held himself in the manner of one ready to inflict damage at any moment, spoke gruffly, and very rarely smiled. Staines thought him wonderful. Once the contract had been signed, Carver's manner became gruffer still. Otago, he said, was past its prime as a goldfield. Staines would do much better to make for the new-built town of Hokitika in the west, where, as rumour had it, a man could make his fortune in a single day. The Hokitika landing was notoriously treacherous, however, and 2 steamers had been wrecked already upon the bar. For this reason, Carver insisted that Staines make the passage to the west coast under sail rather than under steam. If Staines would consent to accompany him firstly to the Custom House, secondly to the outfitters on Princes Street, and thirdly to the Reserve Bank, their arrangement could be finalised by noon. Staines did consent, and within 3 hours he was in possession of a miner's right, a swag, and a ticket to Hokitika upon the schooner Blanche, which was not due to depart Port Chalmers until the morning of the 13th of May. Over the 2 weeks that followed, Staines and Carver saw a great deal of one another. Carver had a month of shore leave while the bark upon which he worked was refitted and recorked. He took his lodging, as Staines also did, at the Hawthorne Hotel on George Street. They very often breakfasted together, and occasionally Staines accompanied Carver in his chores and appointments around the city, chattering all the while. Carver did not discourage this, and although he communicated little beyond a repressed and constant anxiety, Staines flattered himself that his company was a gratifying and much-needed diversion. Emery Staines knew very well that he created a singular impression in the minds of all those whom he met. This knowledge had become, over time, an expectation, as a consequence of which his singularity had become even more pronounced. His manner showed a curious mixture of longing and enthusiasm, which is to say that his enthusiasms were always of a wistful sort, and his longings always enthusiastic. He was delighted by things of an improbable or impractical nature, which he sought out with the open-hearted gladness of a child at play. When he spoke, he did so originally, and with an idealistic agony that was enough to make all but the most rigid of his critics smile. When he was silent, one had the sense, watching him, that his imagination was nevertheless usefully occupied, for he often sighed or nodded, as though in agreement with an interlocutor whom no one else could see. His disposition to be sunny was, it seemed, unshakable. However, this attitude had not been formed in consultation with any moral code. In general, his beliefs were intuitively rather than scrupulously held, and he was not selective in choosing his society, feeling, in his intuitive way, that it was the duty of every thinking man to expose himself to a great range of characters, situations, and points of view. He had read extensively, and although he favoured the Romantics above all others, and never tired of discussing the properties of the sublime, he was by no means a strict disciple of that school, or indeed of any school at all. A solitary, unsupervised childhood, spent for the most part in his father's library, had prepared Emery Staines for a great many possible lives, without ever preferring one. He might just as soon be found in morning dress, debating Cicero and Seneca, as in boots and woolen trousers, ascending a mountain in search of a view, and in both cases he was bound to be enjoying himself a great deal. On his 21st birthday, he was asked where he wished to go in the world, to which he immediately responded, "Otago," knowing that the rushes in Victoria had abated, and having long been enamoured of the idea of the prospector's life, which he conceived of in terms quixotic and alchemical. He saw the metal shining, unseen, undiscovered, upon some lonely beach of some uncharted land. He saw the moon rising full and yellow over the open sea. He saw himself riding on horseback through the shallows of a creek, and sleeping on the bare earth, and running water through a wooden cradle, and twining digger's dough around a stick to bake above the embers of a fire. What a fine thing it would be, he thought, to be able to say that one's fortune was older than all the ages of men and history, to say that one had chanced upon it, had plucked it from the earth with one's own bare hands. His request was granted. Passage was duly bought upon the steamer Fortunate Wind, bound for Port Chalmers. On the day of his departure, his father advised him to keep his wits about him, to practice kindness, and to come home once he had seen enough of the world to know his place in it. Foreign travel, he said, was the very best of educations, and it was a gentleman's duty to see and understand the world. Once they had shaken hands, he presented young Staines with an envelope of paper money, advised him not to spend it all at once, and bid him good morning, quite as if the boy were simply stepping out for a stroll and would be back in time for dinner. "What does he do for a living?" said Carver. "He's a magistrate," said Staines. "A good one?" The boy sighed, throwing his head back a little. "Oh, yes, I suppose he's good. How do I paint a picture of my father? He is a reading man, and he is well regarded in his profession. But he has a queer sense of things. For example, he tells me my inheritance comprises only his fiddle and his shaving razor, saying that if a man is to make his way in the world, all he needs is a good shave and the means to make some music. I believe he's written it into his will like that, and portioned everything else to my mother. He's a little peculiar."
"Oh," said Carver.
They were breakfasting together at the Hawthorne Hotel for the very last time. The next morning, the schooner Blanche was scheduled to depart for Hokitika, with the bark Godspeed, newly corked and fitted, bound for Melbourne some hours later. "Do you know," Staines added as he tapped his egg, "that is the first time since my landing in Dunedin that somebody has asked me what my father does for a living. but I've been asked where I shall make my fortune no less than a dozen times, and I've been offered all kinds of sponsorship, and I couldn't tell you how many times I've been asked what I mean to do with my pile once I've amassed a competence. What a curious phrase that is, a competence. It seems to sell the notion awfully short.
Yes, said Carver, his eyes on the Otago witness.
Are you expecting someone?
Said Staines.
What?
Said Carver, without looking up.
Only that you've been reading the shipping news for the past 10 minutes, said Staines, and you've hardly touched your breakfast.
I'm not waiting for anyone, said Carver. He turned a page of the paper and began to read the Goldfields correspondence. They lapsed into silence for a time. Carver kept his eyes upon the paper. Staines finished his egg. Just as Staines was about to rise from the table and excuse himself, the front door opened, and a penny postman walked in.
"Mr. Francis Carver!" he called.
"That's me," said Carver, raising his hand. He tore open the envelope and scanned the paper briefly. Staines could see, through the thinness of the paper, that the letter was composed of only one line of script.
"I do hope it's not bad news," he said.
Carver did not move for a long moment. Then he crushed the paper in his hand and tossed it sideways into the fire. He reached into his pocket for a penny, and once the postman had scurried away, he turned to Staines and said,
"What would you say to a gold sovereign?"
"I don't believe I've ever addressed one before," said Staines.
Carver stared at him.
"Do you need help?"
Staines said.
"Yes. Come with me."
Staines followed his sponsor up the stairs. He waited while Carver unlocked the door to his private quarters and then stepped into the room after him. He had never set foot in Carver's room before. It was much larger than his own, but similarly furnished. It still held the musty, bodily smell of sleep. Carver's bedclothes were twisted in the centre of the mattress. In the centre of the room was an iron-strapped chest. Pasted to the lid was a yellow bill of lading. Bearer Alistair Lauderback. Shipper Danforth Shipping. Carrier Godspeed.
"I need you to watch over this," said Carver.
"What's inside it?"
"Don't you mind what's inside it. I just need you to watch over it until I come back. 2 hours, maybe. 3 hours. I've got some business uptown. There'd be a sovereign in it for you."
Staines raised his eyebrows.
"A whole sovereign? To watch a chest for 3 hours? Whatever for?"
"You'd be doing me a favour," said Carver. "I don't forget a favour."
"It must be terribly valuable," said Staines.
"To me it is," said Carver. "Do you want the job?"
"Well, all right," said Staines, smiling. "As a favour, I'd be glad."
"You'd best have a pistol," said Carver, going to the bureau.
Staines was so astonished he laughed.
"A pistol," he said.
Carver found a single loading revolver, snapped open the breech, and peered into it. Then he nodded, snapped it back together, and passed it to Staines.
"Should I expect to use this?"
said Staines, turning it over.
"No," said Carver. "Just wave it about if anyone walks in."
"Wave it about?"
"Yes."
"Who's going to walk in?"
"Nobody," said Carver. "Nobody's going to walk in."
"What's in the trunk?" Staines said again. "I really think I ought to know. I can keep a secret."
Carver shook his head.
"The less you know, the better."
"It's not a matter of knowing less. It's a matter of knowing nothing at all. Am I some kind of an accomplice? Is this some kind of a heist? Truly, Mr. Carver, I can keep a secret."
"There's another thing," said Carver. "Just for today, my name isn't Carver. It's Wells. Francis Wells. If anyone comes asking, I'm Francis Wells, never mind why."
"Good Lord," said the boy.
"What?"
"Only that you're being dreadfully mysterious."
Carver rounded on him suddenly.
"If you run off, it'll be a breach of our contract. I'll have grounds to seek recompense in whatever way I see fit."
"I won't run off," said the boy.
"You keep your eye on that trunk until I get back, and you'll walk away with a pound coin. What's my name?"
"Mr. Wells," said the boy.
"Mind you remember it. I'll be 3 hours."
Once Carver had gone, Staines set the pistol on the bureau, the muzzle faced away, and knelt to look at the trunk. The hasp had been padlocked. He lifted the padlock to examine the profile of the keyhole, observing to his satisfaction that the lock was of a very simple design. Smiling suddenly, he took out his clasp knife, unfolded the blade, and fitted the point of his knife into the keyhole. He jimmied it for nearly a minute before the mechanism clicked. Copper. In which Wells' suspicion deepens, Anna becomes alarmed, and a package arrives at the House of Many Wishes, addressed to Mrs. Wells. Crosby Wells read the Otago Witness from top to bottom, and in perfect silence. When he was done, he shook out the paper, folded it crisply along the seam, and rose from his chair. Mrs. Wells was sitting opposite him. Her expression was cold. He advanced upon her, tossed the paper into her lap. She flinched slightly, and then placed his hands on his hips, surveying her.
"Arrivals caught my eye," he said.
She said nothing.
"One name in particular. Active is the name of the steamer. Arriving at the top of the tide.
When's that?"
"Sundown."
Still she said nothing.
"Seems odd you didn't tell me," said Wells. "I've only been waiting, what, 12 years? 12 years and no reply. All these years I've been in the Highlands, digging for gold. Now the man himself arrives in town, and you knew about it, and you made no mention."
"No, it's worse than keeping quiet. You set out to deceive me. You burned the paper in the bloody stove."
"That's a black deceit, Mrs. Wells. That's a cold deceit."
She kept composure.
"You are quite right," she said. "I should never have deceived you."
"Why did you burn it?"
"I didn't want the news to spoil the party," she said. "If you'd discovered he was arriving tonight, you might have gone down to the quay, and he might have spurned you, and you might have become upset."
"But that is just what has me confounded, Mrs. Wells."
"What?" she said.
"The party."
"It's only a party."
"Is it?"
"Crosby," she said, "don't be foolish. If you go looking for a conspiracy, you will find a conspiracy. It's a party, and that's all."
"Gentlemen with marine connections," said Wells. "Naval types. What do you care about naval types?"
"I care that they are men of considerable rank and influence, because I care about my business, and the party will do my business good. Everybody loves a theme. It lends a flavour to an evening."
"Does Mr. Alistair Lauderback get an invite, I wonder?"
"Of course not," said Mrs. Wells. "Why should I invite him? I've never set eyes upon the man in my life. And anyway, as I told you, it was precisely because I didn't want you to get upset that I burned this morning's paper."
"You're very right, I shouldn't have, and I'm very sorry to have deceived you.
But the party, I assure you, is only a party."
"What about the bonanza?" said Wells. "And my papers? How do they fit in?"
"I'm afraid they don't," said Mrs. Wells.
"I have half a mind to take a stroll down to Port Chalmers," said Wells, "around sundown. Nice night for it. Bit chilly, perhaps."
"By all means do so," said Mrs. Wells.
"I'd miss the party, of course."
"That would be a shame."
"Would it?"
She sighed.
"Crosby," she said, "you are being very silly."
He leant closer.
"Where's my money, Mrs. Wells?"
"It is in a vault at the reserve."
"Liar! Where is it?"
"It is in a vault at the reserve."
"Where is it?"
"It is in a vault at the reserve."
"Liar!"
"Insulting me," said Mrs. Wells, "will not—"
He slapped her hard across the face.
"You're a dirty liar," he said. "A rotten thief, and I'll call you worse before I'm through with you."
A perfect silence followed. Mrs. Wells did not reach up to touch her cheek where he had slapped her. She stayed perfectly still, and Wells, suddenly vexed, turned away from her and crossed the room to where the decanters and bottles were set out upon their silver tray. He poured himself a measure, drank it off, and then poured another. Anna kept her eyes on her rope wreath, which was becoming misshapen under her trembling fingers. She did not dare to look at Mrs. Wells. Just then there came a swift knock at the front door, and then a voice calling through the slot, "Package for Mrs. Lydia Wells." Mrs. Wells made to rise, but Crosby Wells shouted, "No!" He had become very flushed. "You stay right there!" He pointed to Anna with the hand that held his glass. "You," he said, "go and see." She did. It was a bottle, pint-sized, wrapped in brown paper, and stamped with the matrix of the chemist on George Street.
"What is it?"
called Wells from the floor above.
"It's a package from the chemist's," Anna called back.
There was a pause, and then Mrs. Wells said, speaking clearly,
"Oh, I know what it is. It's hair tonic. I placed the order last week."
Anna returned upstairs, the package in her hand.
"Hair tonic," said Wells.
"Really, Crosby," said Mrs. Wells, "you are becoming paranoiac."
To Anna, she said, "You can put it in my room, on the nightstand, please." Wells was still glaring at his wife.
"You're not going anywhere," he said. "Not until you tell me the truth. You're staying right here, where I can keep an eye on you."
"In that case, I look forward to a very dull afternoon," said Mrs. Wells.
Crosby Wells responded angrily to this, and they continued bickering. Anna, glad to have a reason to exit, took the paper-wrapped bottle across the hallway and into the hushed darkness of Mrs. Wells' bedroom. She went to set the bottle down upon the nightstand when something caught her eye. A bottle of hair tonic, half the size of the bottle she was holding in her hand, and not at all alike in its dimensions. Frowning, she looked at the package in her hand, and then, on a sudden impulse, slid her finger underneath the wrapping and sloughed the paper away. The bottle was unmarked. It had been corked, and the cork had been sealed with candle wax. She held it up to the light. It contained a thick, treacly liquid, the colour of rust.
"Laudanum," she whispered.
"Wu Jing," in which Emery Staines does Carver's bidding, and Ah Suk is effectively deceived. Staines held the gown up to the light, wondering. There were five in total, one of orange silk and the rest of muslin, but apart from them, the chest was quite empty. What was the meaning of it? Perhaps they held some sentimental value for Carver, but if so, then why had he outfitted Staines with a pistol in watching over them? Perhaps they were stolen goods, though they did not look at all valuable. Or perhaps, Staines thought, Carver was going mad. This thought cheered him. He chuckled aloud, and then, shaking his head, returned the gowns to the chest. There came a sharp knock upon the door.
"Who is it?"
said Staines. There was no answer, but after a moment the caller knocked again.
"Who's there?"
said Staines again. The caller knocked a third time, more urgently. Staines felt his heartbeat quicken. He went to the bureau and picked up the pistol. Holding it flat against his thigh, he walked to the door, unlatched it, and opened it a crack.
"Yes," he said.
In the hallway stood a Chinese man of perhaps 30 years, dressed in a tunic and a woolen cape.
"Francis Carver," he said.
Staines remembered Carver's instruction.
"I'm afraid there's nobody of that name here," he said. "You don't mean Mr. Wells, Francis Wells?"
The Chinese man shook his head.
"Carver,"
he said. He produced a piece of paper from his breast and held it out. Curious, Staines took it. It was a letter from the Cockatoo Island Penitentiary, thanking Mr. Yongsheng for his inquiry and informing him that upon his release from jail, Mr. Francis Carver had sailed for Dunedin, New Zealand, upon the steamer Sparta. At the bottom of the letter, and in a much darker shade of ink, somebody else had written Hawthorne Hotel. Staines stared at the note for a long time. He had not known that Carver was a former convict. The news was striking to him, but he found, upon further reflection, that it was not wholly unexpected. At last, and with great reluctance, he shook his head.
"I'm sorry,"
he said, passing the piece of paper back to the Chinese man and smiling apologetically.
"There's nobody named Francis Carver here."
Iron, in which Crosby Wells puts two and two together. An interminable afternoon passed at No. 35 Cumberland Street. Together, Anna and Mrs. Wells had constructed 15 plaited reeds, which they installed in the parlour downstairs, watched over by Wells, who drank steadily and did not speak. Behind the rostrum they had fashioned a mainsail made from an oar and a white bedsheet, which they reefed with lengths of twine. Behind the bar they had hung a string of Admiralty flags. Once the reeds had been arranged, they set out lemons and spruce liquor, trimmed candles, polished glasses, refilled the spirit lamps, and dusted, stretching each task out as long as possible, and taking every excuse to make small trips upstairs and to the kitchen, so as to avoid the dreadful silence of embittered company. They were interrupted, a little after four, by a brisk knock at the front door.
"Who can that be?"
said Mrs. Wells, frowning.
"The girls aren't due until seven. I never receive callers at this time of day."
"I'll answer it," said Wells.
On the threshold was a Chinese man in a tunic and a woolen cape.
"What have we got here?" said Wells. "You're not a naval man."
"Good afternoon," said the other. "I look for Francis Carver."
"What?" said Crosby Wells.
"I look for Francis Carver."
"Carver, you said?"
"Yes."
"Never heard of him."
"He live here,"
said the Chinese man.
"Afraid he doesn't, mate. This place belongs to a Mrs. Lydia Wells. I'm her lucky husband. Crosby's my name."
"Not Carver?"
"I don't know anyone by the name of Carver," said Wells.
"Francis Carver,"
the man supplied.
"Can't help you, I'm afraid."
The Chinese man frowned. He reached into his pocket and withdrew the same letter that he had presented to Emery Staines some 2 hours prior. He handed it to Wells. The words Hawthorne Hotel had been scratched out. Beneath them, in a different hand, someone had written House of Many Wishes, Cumberland Street.
"Someone gave you this address?" said Wells.
"Yes,"
said the Chinese man.
"Who?"
said Wells.
"Harbour master,"
said the Chinese man.
"I'm afraid the harbour master's put you wrong, mate," said Wells, passing the letter back to him. "There's no one of that name at this address. What's it you wanting him for?"
"To bring to justice," said the Chinese man.
"Justice," said Wells, grinning. "All right. Well, I hope he deserves it. Good luck."
He closed the door, and then suddenly stopped, his hand upon the frame. Suddenly he turned, and taking the steps two at a time, returned upstairs to the boudoir where the Otago Witness was folded upon the bureau. He snatched it up. After scanning the columns for several minutes, he saw, listed among the projected departures for the following day, Jetty 4, Godspeed, destination Port Phillip, crew comprising J. Raxworthy, captain, P. Logan, mate, H. Peterson, second mate, J. Draffin, steward, M. Dewey, cook, W. Collins, bosun, E. Cole, M. Jerrison, C. Solberg, F. Carver, seaman.
"Who was that at the door?"
Anna had come up behind him. She was holding a brass candle holder in each hand.
"Was it Lucy back from the store? Mrs. Wells is wanting her."
"It was a Chinaman," said Wells.
"What did he want?"
"He was looking for someone."
"Who?"
Wells studied her.
"Do you know anyone who ever did time at Cockatoo Island?"
"No."
"Nor do I."
"That's hard labour," said Anna. "Cockatoo is hard labour."
"Not for the faint-hearted, I should think."
"Who was he looking for?"
Wells hesitated, but then he said,
"Ever heard of a Francis Carver?"
"No."
"Ever seen an ex-con?"
"How would I know one?"
"I suppose you wouldn't," said Wells.
There was a pause. Presently she said,
"Should I tell Mrs. Wells?"
"No," said Wells. "Stop a moment."
"I was only supposed to come up for these," said Anna, holding up the candle holders. "I really ought to be getting back."
Wells rolled the Otago Witness into a tube.
"She's a heartless woman, Anna. Not a bone of true feeling in Mrs. Lydia Wells. It's profit or bust. She's taken my money, and she'll take yours, and we'll be ruined, both of us.
We'll be ruined.
Yes,
Anna said miserably.
I know.
He brandished the rolled paper.
Do you know what this says? Man named Carver listed as a crewman on a private charter. Leaving on tomorrow's tide. A gentleman with a marine connection, in other words.
I suppose that means he'll be at the party,
Anna said.
And another thing. The master of the craft, Raxworthy.
Mrs. Wells mentioned him at breakfast,
Anna said.
Indeed she did, said Wells, striking the paper upon his leg. Everything's beginning to add up. Only I can't quite see it yet. The picture.
What's adding up?
All day, he explained. I've been wondering one thing. What could she possibly want with my papers? My miner's right. My birth certificate. I've no doubt she lifted them, and she lifted the bonanza too. But she wouldn't bother with anything unless it could be put to some use. And what use for an old man's papers could she possibly have? None at all, I thought. In that case, she must have dispatched them somehow. Passed them on.
But to whom?
What kind of a man might have need for another man's papers?
That's when it struck me.
A man running from his past, I thought. A man with a tarnished name who wants to start over with a better one. A man looking to put some chapter of his life behind him.
Anna waited, frowning.
Here's a damn certainty, said Wells, holding up the rolled paper like a scepter. I don't know how, and I don't know why or what for, but I'll tell you here and now, little Anna, that tonight I'll be making the acquaintance of a Mr. Francis Carver.
Tin, in which Carver takes an alias and Lauderback signs his name.
Wells, said Lauderback, coming up short. Good evening, said Francis Carver.
He was sitting in a chair facing the gangway. There was a pistol in his hand.
What is this? Said Lauderback. Do come in. What is this?
He said again.
A conversation, said Carver. But what's it about?
I recommend that you step into the cabin, Mr. Lauderback.
Why?
Carver said nothing, but the muzzle of the pistol twitched a little.
I haven't laid my eyes on her since last we spoke, Lauderback said. Upon my honour, when you told me to step away, Mr. Wells, I stepped away. I've been in Akaroa these 9 months past. I only just arrived back in town tonight. Just now, in fact, this very moment. I've kept away, just as you asked of me.
Says you, said Carver.
Yes, says me. Do you doubt my word?
No.
Then what do you mean, says me?
Only that on paper it says different.
Lauderback faltered.
I have not the slightest idea of what paper you're talking about, he said after a moment. I shall hazard to guess, however, that you are alluding in some way to the Danforth receipt.
I am, said Carver.
With a swift look over his shoulder, Lauderback stepped into the cabin and pulled the hatch closed behind him.
All right, he said when he was inside. Something's cooking. Or cooked.
Yes, said Carver.
Is this about Crosby? Said Lauderback. Is this something to do with Crosby?
You know, said Carver, I worry about old Crosby.
He did not go on. After a moment, Lauderback said in a fearful voice,
Do you?
Yes, I do, said Carver. One of these days, that poor man is going to drink himself to death.
Lauderback had begun to sweat.
Where's Raxworthy? He said.
Getting drunk on Cumberland Street, I believe.
What about Danforth?
The same, said Carver.
They're in your pocket, are they?
No, said Carver. You are.
Tar, in which Carver comes to finish the deed. Crosby Wells makes a counterattack, and the laudanum takes effect. When Francis Carver rapped upon the door of No. 35 Cumberland Street some 2 hours later, the naval party was in full swing. He could hear rhythmic clapping and the stamp of feet and raucous laughter. He knocked again, more sharply.
The maid, Lucy, appeared after his fourth knock. Once she saw that it was Carver, she invited him inside and flew down the passage to summon Mrs. Wells.
"Oh, Francis," she said when she saw him. "Thank heavens."
"It came off," said Carver.
He patted his breast where the deed of sale lay folded in his inside pocket.
"Everything signed. Effective instant. I've got a boy keeping an eye on him, Lauderback, until the morning. But I doubt he'll do any talking."
"You didn't hurt him, did you?"
"No. He's feeling very sorry for himself, that's all. What's been happening here?"
She dropped her voice to a whisper.
"Well," she said, "after that awful brawl this morning and a wretched day, we've had the most incredible luck. Crosby's taken up with my new girl. Perhaps he thought to spite me by taking her to bed, but I couldn't have thought of anything I wanted more than to have the two of them out of the way for the evening. The moment they were alone, I sent up Lucy with a fresh decanter."
"Laced?"
"Of course."
"How strong?"
"I used half the bottle."
"Anything come of it?"
"I haven't heard a peep," she said. "Not a sound."
"All right," he said. "I'll go up. I'll need 15 minutes.
"He's very angry. He knows about the gold, as I told you. And he found out about Lauderback arriving. You must be careful."
"I won't need to be careful if he's sourced."
"You won't shoot him, will you, Francis?"
"Don't worry your head about it."
"I want to know."
"I'll tap him on the head," said Carver. "That's all."
"Not here."
"No, not here. I'll take him someplace else."
"The girl's still up there, you know. She might have gone down with him. I don't know."
"I'll deal with her. I'll tell her to leave before anything happens. Don't you worry."
"What should I do?"
"Get on back to the party. Pour Raxworthy another drink."
Carver put his ear to the door. Hearing nothing, he eased the door handle very quietly. It opened without a sound. The room was dark, but in the chamber beyond, a small lamp was burning. There was someone in the bed. The bedclothes were mounded, and he could see a splash of dark hair on the pillow. Keeping his hand on his hip, he moved slowly forward into the room. He heard the whistle of something heavy slicing through air and almost turned, but before he could do so, he was clubbed on the back of the head and he stumbled to his knees. He whirled about, his hand closing around the grip of his pistol, but Crosby Wells swung the poker again, cracking him across the knuckles and again across the jaw. Carver recoiled in pain. He brought his hands up instinctively to protect his face. A fourth strike made contact with his elbow, and a fifth cracked him just above his temple. He collapsed sideways, suddenly weak, upon the floor. Wells darted forward and tried to yank the pistol from the man's belt with his free hand. Carver grabbed his arm, and they tussled a moment, until Wells cracked him another time across the side of the head with the poker. He lost his grip and fell back. At last, Wells gained purchase on the pistol and wrenched it free. Once it was in his hand, he cocked it, leveled it in Carver's face, and stood a moment, panting. Carver grunted, bringing his arms up to his face. He was dazed. The lights in the room had begun to pulse.
"Who are you?"
Carver peered at him. There was blood in his mouth. Wells was holding the pistol in his left hand and the poker in his right. He raised the poker a little, threatening to strike again.
"Are you Francis Carver? You speak or I'll shoot you dead. Is your name Carver?"
"Used to be," said Carver.
"What is it now?"
Carver grinned at him, showing bloody teeth.
"Crosby Wells," he said.
Wells came closer.
"I'll kill you," he said.
"Go ahead," said Carver, and closed his eyes.
Wells raised the poker again.
"Where's my bonanza?"
"Gone."
"Where is it?" I said.
"Shipped offshore."
"Who shipped it? You?"
Carver opened his eyes.
"No," he said. "You did."
Wells brought the poker down. It glanced off the other man's temple, and Carver fainted away. Wells waited a moment to see if he was shamming, but the faint was plainly real. He was showing the whites of his eyes, and one of his hands was twitching. Wells laid the poker down out of Carver's reach. He transferred the pistol to his right hand. Tentatively, he pushed the muzzle of the pistol into Carver's cheek and nudged him. The man's head rolled back.
"Is he dead?"
said Anna from the doorway. Her face was white.
"No, he's breathing."
With his left hand, Wells took his bowie knife from his boot and unsheathed the blade.
"Will you kill him?"
Anna whispered.
"No."
"What will you do?"
Wells did not answer. Using his pistol to keep Carver's head steady, he inserted the point of his knife just below the outer corner of Carver's left eye. Blood welled up instantly, running thickly down his cheek. With a sudden flick of his wrist, Wells twisted the blade, slicing from his eye down to his jaw. He leapt back, but Carver did not wake. He only gurgled. His cheek was now awash with blood. It was running off the line of his jaw and soaking into his collar.
"C for Carver," said Wells quietly, staring at him. "You're a man to remember now, Francis Carver. You're the man with the scar."
He looked up and caught Anna's eye. Her hands were over her mouth. She looked horrified. He jerked his chin at the decanter on the sideboard.
"Have a drink," he said. "You'll be asleep in a minute. Only you better do it fast."
Anna glanced at the decanter. The laudanum had darkened the whiskey very slightly, giving the liquid a coppery glow.
"How much?" she said.
"As much as you can stomach," said Wells. "And then lie down on your side, not your back. You'll drown on yourself otherwise."
"How long will it take?"
"No time at all," said Crosby Wells.
He wiped his knife on the carpet, sheathed it, and then stood, ready to leave.
"Wait!"
Anna ran into the bedroom. A moment later, she returned with the gold nugget that he had first given her the afternoon of their first encounter.
"Here,"
she said, pressing it into his hands.
"Take it. You can use it to get away."
Makeweights, in which Crosby Wells asks for help, a customs agent becomes angry, and a bill of lading is recalled.
"Psst! Bill!"
The official looked up from his newspaper.
"Who's that?"
"It's Wells. Crosby Wells."
"Come out where I can see you."
"Here."
He emerged into the light, palms up.
"What are you doing, creeping about in the dark?"
Wells took another step forward. Still with his palms up, he said,
"I need a favour."
"Oh?"
"I need to get on a ship, first light."
The official's eyes narrowed.
"Where are you bound?"
"It doesn't matter," said Wells. "Anywhere. I just need to go quiet."
"What's in it for me?"
Wells opened his left fist. There, against his palm, was the nugget that Anna had returned to him. The official looked at it, making a mental estimation of its worth, and then said,
"What about the law?"
"I'm on side with the law," said Wells.
"Who's on your heels, then?"
"Man named Carver," said Wells.
"What's he got on you?"
"My papers," said Wells. "And a fortune. He lifted a fortune from my safe."
"When did you ever make a fortune?"
"At Dunstan," said Wells. "Maybe a year ago. 15 months.
"You kept bloody quiet about it."
"Course I did. I never told a soul but Lydia."
The man laughed.
"That was your first mistake, then?"
"No," said Wells. "My last."
They looked at each other. Presently, Bill said,
"May not be worth it. For me."
"I go aboard tonight. Hide away. Sail first thing. You keep this nugget, and I keep my life. That's all. You don't need to get me on board. Just tell me which ship is leaving and turn a blind eye as I walk past."
The official wavered. He put aside his paper and leant forward to check the schedule pinned above his desk.
"There's a schooner bound for Hokitika leaving at first light," he said after a moment. "The Blanche."
"You tell me where she's anchored," said Wells. "Give me a window. That's all I'm asking, Bill."
The official pursed his lips, considering it. He turned back to the schedule, as though the best course of action might somehow present itself to him in writing. Then his gaze sharpened, and he said,
"Hang on. Wells."
"What?"
This inventory says it was authorized by you.
Frowning, Wells stepped forward.
Let me see.
But Bill pulled the log towards him, away from Wells' reach.
There's a crate going to Melbourne, he said, scanning the entry. It's been loaded on Godspeed. And you signed for it.
He looked up, suddenly angry.
What's all this about?
I don't know, said Wells.
Can I see it?
You're spinning me a line, said Bill.
I'm not, said Wells. I never signed that bloody thing.
Your money's in that crate, said Bill. You're sending your colour offshore, while you hop over to Hokitika to cover your tracks, and when it's all safe and sound, you'll sally across the Tasman and make yourself over tax-free.
No, said Wells. That wasn't me.
The official flapped his hand disgustedly.
Go on, keep your bloody nugget. I don't want a part in any scheme.
Wells said nothing for a moment. He stared at the dark shapes of the ships at anchor, the broken needles of light upon the water, the hanging lanterns squeaking in the wind. Then he said, speaking carefully,
That wasn't me who signed.
Bill scowled.
No, he said. Don't start. You won't take me for a fool. My certificates, said Wells. My miner's right. My papers, everything. It was all in the safe at Cumberland Street. I swear to you. This man Carver, he's an ex-convict. Served time at Cockatoo. He took it all. I have nothing but the shirt on me back, Bill. Francis Carver is using my name.
Bill shook his head.
No, he said. That crate's not going offshore. I'm pulling the inventory first thing in the morning. Pull it now, said Wells. I'll take the crate with me to Hokitika. Nothing's going offshore that way, is it? Everything's legal that way.
The official looked down at the inventory and then back at Wells.
I don't want a part in any racket. You'd have done nothing wrong, said Wells. Nothing at all. It's only evasion of duty if you send it offshore. I'll even sign for it. I'll sign anything you like.
Bill did not say anything for a long moment, and Wells knew that he was considering it.
I can't get it on the Blanche, he said at last. She's sailing first light, and Parrish has signed off on the cargo already. There isn't time. Send it on after, then. I'll sign a transfer right now. I'm begging you.
No need to beg, said Bill, frowning.
Wells came forward and placed the nugget on the desk. For a moment, the thing seemed to shiver like the needle of a compass. Bill looked at the nugget for a long moment. Then he looked up and said,
No, you keep your nugget, Crosby Wells. I don't want a part in any scheme.
Part 6. The Widow and the Weeds. The 18th of June, 1865. 42 degrees, 43 minutes south. 170 degrees, 58 minutes east. Hokitika. Fixed Earth. In which Emery Staines takes his metal to the bank. Crosby Wells proposes a deceit. And Staines begins to doubt his first impression, much too late. Emery Staines was yet to make a strike in Hokitika. He had not yet found a patch of ground he liked well enough to stake, or indeed, a company he liked well enough to join. He had amassed a small competence in dust, but the pile had been collected variously from beaches both north and south of the river, and from small gullies on the far side of the Hokitika Gorge. It was an inconstant yield, of which the greater portion by far had already disappeared. Staines tended towards profligacy whenever the time and money spent were his very own. He far preferred to sleep and dine in the society of others than to do so alone in his tent beneath the stars, the romance of which did not endure, he discovered, past the first experience. He had not been prepared for the bitterness of the West Canterbury winter, and was very frequently driven indoors by the rain. With poor weather as his excuse, he drank wine and ate salt beef and played at cards every evening, venturing out the next morning to fill his handkerchief anew. Had it not been for his agreement with Francis Carver, he might have continued in this haphazard way indefinitely, which is to say, following a two-part pattern of excess and recovery. But he had not forgotten the conditions of his sponsorship, under which he would shortly be obliged to throw down an anchor, as the diggers termed it, and invest. On the morning of the 18th of June, Staines woke early. He had spent the night at a flophouse in Canieri, a long, low clapboard shanty with a lean-to kitchen and hammock strung in tiers. There was a damp chill in the air. As he dressed, his breath showed white. Outside, he paid a halfpenny for a plate of porridge ladled from a steaming vat and ate standing, gazing eastward to where the ridge of the high Alps formed a crisp silhouette against the winter sky. When the plate was clean, he returned it to the hatch, tipped his hat to his fellows, and set off for Hokitika, where he intended to make an appointment with a gold buyer preparatory to purchasing a claim. As he came around the river to the spit, he perceived a ship make its stately approach into the neck of the harbour. It glided into the roadstead and seemed to hover, broadside to the river, in the deep water on the far side of the bar. Staines admired the craft as he walked around the long curve of the quay. It was a handsome, three-masted affair, none too large, with a figurehead carved in the shape of an eagle, its beak wide and screaming, its wings outspread. There was a woman at the port side rail. From this distance, Staines could not make out her face, much less her expression, but he supposed that she was lost in a reverie, for she stood very still, both hands gripping the rail, her skirts whipping about her legs, the strings of her bonnet slapping at her breast. He wondered what preoccupied her, whether she was absorbed in a memory, a scene recalled, or in a forecast, something that she wished for, something that she feared. At the Reserve Bank, he produced his kid pouch of dust, and, at the banker's request, surrendered its contents to be examined and weighed. The valuation took some time, but the eventual price offered was a good one, and Staines left the building with a paper note made out for £20 folded in his vest pocket against his heart.
"Stop you there, lad."
Staines turned. On the steps of the bank, just rising, was a sandy-haired man, perhaps 50 in age. His skin was very weathered, and his nose very red. He sported a patchy, week-old beard, the stubble of which was quite white.
"Can I help you?" said Staines.
"You can answer me a couple of questions," said the man. "Here's the first. Are you a company man?"
"I'm not a company man."
"All right. Here's the second. Honesty or loyalty?"
"Excuse me?"
"Honesty or loyalty," said the man. "Which do you value higher?"
"Is this a trick?"
"A genuine inquiry,
if you wouldn't mind."
"Well," said Staines, frowning slightly, "that's very difficult to say. Which to value higher, honesty or loyalty? From a certain point of view, one might say that honesty is a kind of loyalty, a loyalty to the truth. Though one would hardly call loyalty a kind of honesty. I suppose that when it came down to it, if I had to choose between being dishonest but loyal or being disloyal but honest, I'd rather stand by my men, or by my country, or by my family, than by the truth. So I suppose I'd say loyalty, in myself. But in others? In the case of others, I feel quite differently. I'd much prefer an honest friend to a friend who was merely loyal to me, and I'd much rather be loyal to an honest friend than to a sycophant. Let's say that my answer is conditional. In myself, I value loyalty. In others, honesty."
"That's good," said the man. "That's very good."
"Is it?"
said Staines, smiling now.
"Have I passed some kind of a test?"
"Almost," said the man. "I'm after a favour. In good faith. And on your terms. Look here."
He reached into his pocket and withdrew a nugget around the size of a short cigar. He held it up so that it caught the light.
"Nice, isn't it?"
"Very nice,"
said Staines, but he was no longer smiling. The man continued,
"Pick this up in the Clutha Valley. Otago way. Been carrying it about for a month, 2 months. But I'm wanting to turn it into land, you see. Got my eye on a patch of land, and the land agent won't touch anything but paper money. Here's the problem. I've been robbed. Got no proof of my own identity. My papers, my miner's right, everything's gone. So I can't bank this nugget on my own accord."
"Ah,"
said Staines. What I'm after is a favour. You take this nugget into the bank. Say it's your own, that you found it, on Crown land. Change it into paper money for me. It wouldn't take you half an hour all up. You can name your price.
I see, said Staines, uncertainly. He hovered a moment.
Surely, he said, you might simply explain your situation to the fellows inside. You might tell them that you'd been robbed, as you've just told me.
I can't do that, said the man.
There are always records, said Staines. Even if you don't have your papers, they'll have other ways of tracking who you are. The shipping news and so forth.
The man shook his head. I was on an Otago certificate, he said, and I never came through the custom house when I arrived. There's no record of me here.
Oh,
said Staines, who was beginning to feel very uncomfortable. The man stepped forward. I'm telling you a straight story, lad. The nugget's mine. Picked it up in the Clutha Valley. I'll sketch the place for you. I'll draw you a bloody map. My story's straight.
Staines looked again at the nugget.
Can anyone vouch for you? He said.
I haven't gone waving this about, the man snapped, shaking his fist. Where would be the sense in that? I've been robbed already. I won't be robbed again. There's only one soul on earth who's touched this piece besides me. Young woman by the name of Anna Wetherill. She'd vouch for the truth of what I'm telling you. But she's in Dunedin, isn't she? And I can't stand about waiting for the post.
The name Anna Wetherill meant nothing to Staines, and he registered it only dimly as he considered the best way to withdraw. The man's story was not at all convincing. It seemed obvious to Staines that the nugget had been stolen and that the thief, fearing capture, was now attempting to cover his tracks by employing an innocent third man to turn the evidence to untraceable cash, and his countenance did not reassure. He had the weary, bloodshot look of a man long since ruined by drink. Even at a distance of several paces, Staines could smell yesterday's liquor on his clothes and on his breath. Stalling for time, he said, "Land agent, did you say?" The man nodded.
There's an acreage I'm keen on. Arahura way. Timber, that's the business. I'm through with chasing gold. I had a fortune, and now it's gone. And that's the end of the game as far as I'm concerned. Timber, that's honest work.
What's your name?
Crosby Wells, said the man.
Staines paused.
Wells, he said.
That's right, said the man.
Suddenly he scowled.
What's it to you?
Staines was remembering the strange injunction that Francis Carver had given him at the Hawthorne Hotel in George Street 1 month prior.
Just for today, he had said. My name's Wells. Francis Wells.
Crosby Wells,
Staines repeated now.
That's it, said Wells, still scowling. No middle name, no nickname, no alias. Nothing but plain old Crosby Wells. Ever since the day I was born. Can't prove it, of course. Can't prove a damn thing without me papers.
Staines hesitated again. After a moment, he put out his hand and said,
Emery Staines.
Wells transferred the nugget to his other hand and they shook.
Care to name your price, Mr. Staines? I'll be very much obliged to you.
Listen, said Staines suddenly. You don't happen to know... I mean, forgive me, but you don't happen to know a man named Francis Carver?
For he still did not know the full story of what had happened on the day before he left Dunedin, where Carver had gone that afternoon, why he had chosen to assume an alias, why he had afforded such importance to a small chest containing nothing but 5 unremarkable gowns. Wells had stiffened. He said, in a voice that was newly hard,
Why?
I'm very sorry, said Staines. Perhaps it's of no consequence. I only ask because, well, about a month ago, a man named Carver took on your surname, just for an afternoon, and never told me why or what for.
Wells' hands had balled into fists.
What's Carver to you?
I don't know him well, said Staines, taking a step back. He stood me some money, that's all.
What kind of money? How much?
£8, said Staines.
What?
8, said Staines, and then again, £8.
Wells advanced on him.
Friend, is he?
Not in the least, said Staines, stepping back again. I found out later that he was a con, that he'd served 10 years with Labour. But it was too late by then. I'd signed.
Signed what?
A sponsorship agreement, said Staines.
And he signed in my name?
No, said Staines, putting up his hands. He only used it, your name, I mean, but I don't know what for. Look, I'm ever so sorry to distress you.
He was the one, said Crosby Wells. He was the one who took my papers. Cheated me out of a pile in Pure. Turned my own wife against me. He took my name and my money, and he tried to take my life. Only the job didn't come off, did it? I got out. I'm still here, working for a pittance, and living hand to mouth, and keeping me head down, and looking over me shoulder every moment till I'm fairly driven mad. This, he brandished the nugget, is all I've got left.
Why do you not bring the law against him? Said Staines. All that sounds like evidence enough.
Wells did not reply at once. Then he said,
Where is he?
I believe he's in Dunedin still.
Are you sure about that?
As much as I can be, said Staines. I've his address. I'm to write to him as soon as I make my first venture.
You're his partner.
Wells spat out the word.
No, I'm obliged to him, that's all. He stood me £8, and I'm to make him an investment in return.
You're his partner. You're his man.
Look, said Staines, alarmed again. Whatever Mr. Carver's done to you, Mr. Wells, and whatever his reasons, I don't know anything about it. Truly. Why, if I'd known anything, I'd never have mentioned his name to you just now, would I? I'd have kept my mouth shut.
Wells said nothing. They stared at one another, each searching the other's expression. Then Staines said,
I'll do it. I'll take your nugget to the bank.
Mars in Cancer, in which Carver begins his search for Crosby Wells, Edgar Clinch offers his services, and Anna Wetherill hardens her resolve. Godspeed crossed the Hokitika Bar at the highest point of the tide. It took Captain Carver the better part of an hour to negotiate the traffic in the river mouth, for several crafts were departing, and he was obliged to wait for a signal from Gibson Key before he could approach the wharf. Anna Wetherill, standing alone on deck, had ample time to take a measure of the view. Hokitika was smaller than she had envisaged, and much more exposed. Compared with the city of Dunedin, which was tucked away down the long arm of the Otago Harbour and enclosed on all sides by hills, Hokitika's proximity to the ocean seemed almost fearsome. To Anna, the buildings had a grim, forsaken look, made somehow wretched by the strings of red and yellow bunting that crossed back and forth between the roof lines and the awnings of the waterfront hotels. A sudden clanging directed her attention to the quay, where a ginger-haired man with a moustache was standing on the wharf, swinging a brass handbell and shouting into the wind. He was plainly advertising something, but his litany of recommendations was quite inaudible beneath the peal of the bell, the mouth of which was big enough to admit a round of bread, and the clapper as thick and heavy as a bar of bullion. It produced a dolorous, inexorable sound, muffled by the distance and by the wind. The journey from Dunedin had marked Godspeed's inaugural voyage under the command of Francis Carver, who had been so incapacitated by the multiple injuries that he had incurred on the night of the 12th of May that he had failed to make Godspeed's scheduled departure for Melbourne the following afternoon. He had missed, as a consequence, any opportunity to inform Captain Raxworthy that the ship's ownership had changed. Raxworthy was punctual by nature, and would not suffer the bark's departure to be delayed on account of a tardy crewman. He had sailed on schedule, his own severe headache notwithstanding, and after Godspeed left her anchor at Port Chalmers, Carver could do nothing but wait for her return. He passed the next 4 weeks in convalescence, watched over by an anxious Mrs. Wells, who could not look upon his facial disfigurement without despair. The wound had been stitched, and the stitches since removed. It now formed an ugly pinkish weal, as thick as a length of sisal, and puckered at both ends. He touched the scar very often with his fingertips, and had taken to covering it with his hand when he spoke. When Godspeed returned from Port Phillip on the 14th of June, Carver met with James Raxworthy to inform him that his tenure as captain had come to an end. The bark had been sold from under him, and, by order of the ship's new owner, a Mr. Wells, Carver himself had been promoted to the captaincy, an honour that gave him the licence to disband Raxworthy's crew and assemble his own. The meeting between Carver and his former captain was long and not at all cordial. Relations became further strained when Carver discovered that a certain item had been struck from Godspeed's inventory 1 month ago. He appealed to Raxworthy, who only shrugged. As far as he could see, there had been no breach of regulation or protocol in the trunks having been recalled. Carver's fury turned to anguish. He applied to the custom house, and to all the shipping firms along the quay, and to all the doss houses in the sailors' district. His inquiries turned up nothing. Poring over the shipping news of the Otago Witness later that evening, he discovered that, besides Godspeed, there had been only one departure from Port Chalmers on the 13th of May, the schooner Blanche, bound for Hokitika.
"It's hardly even a clue," he said to Mrs. Wells, "but I can't stand to do nothing. If I do nothing, I'll go mad. I've still got his birth certificate, after all, and the miner's right. I'll say my name is Crosby Wells, and I'll say I've lost a shipping crate. I'll offer a reward for its return."
"But what about Crosby himself?" said Mrs. Wells. "There's a chance..."
"If I see him," said Carver, "I'll kill him."
"Francis..."
"I'll kill him."
"He will be expecting you to pursue him. He won't be caught off guard, not a second time."
"Neither will I."
The day before Godspeed's departure, Anna Wetherill was summoned to the downstairs parlour, where she found Mrs. Wells waiting for her.
"Now that Mr. Carver has recovered his health," said Mrs. Wells, "I can turn my mind to less pressing matters, such as the matter of your future. You cannot remain in my household even a moment longer, Miss Wetherill, and you know the reason why." "Yes, ma'am,"
Anna whispered.
"I might have turned a blind eye to your betrayal," Mrs. Wells went on, "and suffered in silence, as is a woman's lot. The violence brought upon Mr. Carver, however, I cannot ignore. Your alliance with my husband has passed beyond